Okay, so thanks for giving me a chance to speak. So this is a talk not about many body localization, but about a certain species of zero temperature of interacting metal insulator transitions. So some of the physics is unique to these particular systems, which have topology that plays an important role. But a lot of the ingredients are actually generic to the technology that has been historically used to understand the interacting Anderson metal insulator transition. And maybe the thought is that some of that technology might eventually be useful to understand something like MBL coming from the metallic side. But I won't say anything about MBL in this talk. And I should say, so the work was done in collaboration mainly with my postdoc, Hongyi Shi, who's here, and my graduate student, Yangzi Xiao, who is not, and Emilius Boshin, who is supposed to be here, but is missing in action. So there won't be much topology in this talk, but let me sort of set the stage a little bit by reviewing what's special about the quantum Hall effect. So, and in particular, when I mean topology, I'm only interested in the non-trivial surface or edge states. So I'm not going to have anything to say about bulk topology or invariance or anything like this. So if you think about a normal 1D quantum wire, you have particles that move to the left and the right. But because you're in this confined one-dimensional geometry, scattering is very important. So you have electron-electron scattering, you have scattering off of any impurities you might have in the wire. And so, of course, left and right movers are not independently conserved. And as a result, although, unless you have superconductivity, the total charge is conserved, there's no guarantee it will flow. Generically, you'll have Anderson localization. So contrast that to the quantum Hall effect, where you take your right and left edges and you split them by a macroscopically large bulk. And in that case, there's simply no way for your right movers to scatter off of left movers or to scatter off of impurities and become left movers without tunneling across, some macroscopic distance. And so one way to say that theoretically is that in the quantum Hall effect, there's an emergence of an anomalous symmetry at the edge. And this is sort of a generic property of at least weakly interacting topological phases, that you have some global topology in the bulk, and that's reflected by an anomalous local symmetry in the edge. And so in the case of quantum Hall effect, it's just the separate conservation of left and right movers, at least unless you're doing a Wahlheim experiment and you're pumping through the bulk. And so as a result, in the quantum Hall effect, these left and right edges form a perfect quantum wire with Hall conductance E squared over H. So this talk is about topological superconductors. So as you all know, a solid-state superconductor, you have a superfluid that has zero electrical resistance, but typically, except in some exotic pairing situations, the bulk superfluid will not transport spin, and it will never transport heat. It's isoentropic. So what is a topological superconductor? A topological superconductor is a fully gapped bulk superconductor which is theorized to possess a surface fluid of so-called Majorana fermions. And I should clarify just at the beginning, these are just fermions. They're like quasi-particles. They're like gapless quasi-particles that you have in the cuprates. So this is not like, these are not zero modes. They don't have non-abelian statistics. You're not going to braid with them. You're not going to do quantum computing with them. It's just you have a chunk of superconductor, and on the surface, you have quasi-particles running around on the surface. And we want to ask, what are the physical properties of that surface quasi-particle gas?
Why is Majorana in quotation marks?
I put it in quotation marks because people use this term to mean many different things now. So these are just ordinary fermions, not zero modes. People often say Majorana fermion, they mean zero modes with non-abelian statistics. I think this is the original use. Okay, so this new idea, which really was sort of suggested by Volovic back in the 80s, but really came out of this paper by Andreas and company in 2008, and shortly thereafter the classification paper by Kataev, is the notion of three-dimensional solid-state topological superconductivity. So like I said, you have a fully gapped superconducting bulk with certain properties, and on the surface you have quasi-particles running around. And so the goal of this talk is to ask, well, what are the physical properties of these surface states? What are their transport properties? And also, are they stable, say, to the presence of disorder? Is there Anderson localization? And also, what if you have disorder and interactions? And this turns out to be a rare case where you have a disordered interacting system, but we actually have analytical methods that can say something. I won't say much about experimental realizations. The only known bona fide, or at least believed to be, topological superfluid is actually not solid state at all. It's helium-3b, as noted by Volovic way back in the day. There have been various proposals for solid state realizations. The original one was due to Fu and Berg and copper bismuth selenide. People are now looking at doped Dirac semi-metals and, you know, these types of systems, but I think the jury is still out.
So, I don't know what helium-3b is, but should I think of spin as being unimportant to all of this, or is it?
No, so I'll say a little bit about that. So there's three different classes, and the three classes are separated by the amount of spin conservation. So you can have a case with full sort of Rochebeth spin orbit coupling where there's no spin conservation, that's helium-3b. But you can also, in principle, have a class, class A3, where you have a U1 remnant of spin conservation, that would be like a P-wave superfluid. And you can have something with, in principle, full spin conservation, like which would be like a topological superconducting analog of the cuprates. So, but the only one that's been thought about is the one with full Rochebeth spin orbit coupling.
Okay, but if spin is, the reason I'm asking, if spin is not the crucial part of the story, and it sort of comes into self-classification, then should I think of it as a gapped P-wave superconductor, more or less? So are all gapped P-wave superconductors topological? Just sharpen comment for you.
Well, so typically, so the only models that people really study of topological superconductors that are P-wave are in 2D, and that's P plus IP. So it's a different beast because it breaks time reversal, and you have edge states that only carry heat. Spin is not playing a role there. We can write down some model that's a fully gapped time reversal invariant 3D P-wave superconductor. And in that case, so I would say that there is a U1 conservation by definition if you're in that particular class. But
okay,
I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about universality classes because it's not really that important. But so the question we want to ask is, what do these surface states look like? And so, you know, there are bulk models that you can go to, lattice models of topological superconductivity for all three of these classes. So like I said, there are three different classes of topological superconductors, and they only depend on the amount of spin conservation you have in the bulk. So you can have something with full spin orbit coupling, that's class D3, that would be copper bismuth selenide if copper bismuth selenide is a topological superconductor. But you can also have these other two classes, class A3 where there's a U1 remnant, and class C1 where there's full spin SU2. And I'll sort of talk about all of them in the sense that, well, I'll give results for all of them, and which class we're sort of doing calculations with depends on convenience. So if you ask what do these surface states look like, well, at least for these simple models, and there's some general arguments, the answer is that the surface state should look a lot like graphene, or a lot like the surface of a 3D topological insulator. So meaning that you just have some massless Dirac particles running around on the surface. So the generic Hamiltonian, say if I look at a large two-dimensional surface, is just going to be some massless Dirac fermion. Now here, technically, I've written in terms of a complex Dirac fermion. That depends on the class, whether there's a U1 remnant of spin conservation. If I'm talking class D3 where there's no spin conservation, then this guy would be real, but that's a technical detail. But so there's some pseudo-spin degree of freedom. Just like in graphene. In graphene, it would be the sublattice. Here, it's some admixture of particle hole and some orbital degrees of freedom, depends on the microscopics. But in addition, there's another index on this psi, which I've suppressed here. And that's like a valley or color index, if you wish. And it runs from 1 to the number of winding numbers, to the winding number. So in the way topological superconductors work, it's different from a TI. Whatever winding number you have in the bulk, you just have that many copies of Dirac fermion, Dirac or Meyron fermions living on the surface. And okay, so the crucial point, the question you should immediately ask is, you know, how is this two-dimensional Dirac system any different or more interesting or less interesting than graphene or the surface of a TI? And the answer is the way symmetry works for this surface Dirac fluid. And so it turns out that time reversal symmetry is encoded in a highly anomalous way. It's encoded in this so-called chiral condition, which is that the single particle Hamiltonian anticommutes with some matrix. If sigma 1 and sigma 2 are the current operators, then this matrix turns out to be sigma 3. This is all basis dependent in terms of the way it looks, but it turns out that there's actually only two, for in a given symmetry class, there's only two ways to define time reversal. That was worked out by Bernard and Leclerc, who were just sort of classifying random Dirac fermion Hamiltonians back in the early 2000s. And it turns out that in three of the classes in two dimensions, there's sort of an anomalous version. And that's what these surface Majorana fluids of topological superconductors realize. They realize these anomalous versions of the three random matrix classes. So this weird version of time reversal symmetry, which you can read more about in Andreas's paper, it plays a crucial role. So for example, if I ask, what does disorder do? Let me imagine that, you know, at the surface of my crystal, I've got dislocations, I've got neutral ad atoms, I have charge impurities, I have, you know, any kind of junk on the surface. How does it enter the low energy effective field theory for the Majorana fluid? And the answer is it enters in a very anomalous way. It enters only as a vector potential. And typically, if I have multiple such valleys, so two or more valleys, this is going to be a non-abelian vector potential. So the effective low energy theory of this surface Majorana fluid is something like quenched quantum proton dynamics. It's like Dirac or Majorana fermions moving around in some frozen sea of non-abelian gauge fluctuations. Okay. So.
Valley.
I'm using them interchangeably, so valley color. So I want to talk about sort of two different aspects of these models. The first is transport, and then the second is the stability of these surface states. So let's first ask, you know, what are the transport properties? So if I think about one of the classes where spin is conserved, then I can measure, in principle, spin conductivity. It might be hard to do in practice, but at least theoretically, I can think about it. And so you all know that in low dimensions, transport type tends to be... Yes, Marcus?
How would you measure that in practice, actually?
So, I mean, in principle, you could try to use a ferromagnetic lead and inject spin.
How do you separate bulk from surface?
Well, your bulk is fully gapped. There are no quasi-particles in the bulk. You're supposed to do this at arbitrarily low temperatures. And if you're at least in, say, class C1, where the bulk is singlet paired, then there's nothing in the bulk. The superfluid itself doesn't carry spin. Okay. So the only spin transport you can get comes from the surface.
Did the people just make a thermal conductivity?
Sorry?
Thermal conductivity, if you have a U1 spin, then this is Friedmann-Franz law. If you have a U1 spin symmetry, then people make thermal conductivity.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And then use the Redmond-Franz law related to spin conductivity.
Exactly, and so, yeah, and so in all of these cases, what you really would want to measure is the heat conductance of the surface. I'm going to talk about spin conductance to start with because I want to consider interaction corrections and if you actually want to calculate the thermal conductivity directly, then you have to do this Luttinger trick and things are more complicated. So we haven't done that. So let's think about, say, the spin conductivity. So I can formally write down the Kubo formula for this surface Majorana fluid just in terms of exact single particle advance and retarded Green's functions. So I can always do this. And there are two terms. There's the term you usually think of as giving rise to the conductivity has an advanced Green's function and a retarded Green's function. And there's some other term that we usually don't worry about, which has two Green's functions of the same type. Marcus.
Will this conductance depend on the length of the sample or the independent?
So it's a conductivity that is independent of geometry. It's different from 1D. It's not so. Whether you want to call it ballistic or diffusive, it's not really ballistic transport, but it will turn out that there are no corrections to some minimal.
It doesn't depend on the aspect ratio of the.
It shouldn't depend on the aspect ratio. It's an intensive quantity.
Can I ask? Yes. So, this is spin, this is physical spin, this is
yes.
pseudo anything.
Right, sure.
Right, so if I expose my sample to a field gradient, Zeeman field gradient.
Yes.
And then if I try to measure magnetizations, basically I equilibrate in the Zeeman field gradient and let it take off. Is there anything funny in here that would disallow me to connect this conductivity to just the diffusion constant?
No, so I mean that should be you. Put a spatially varying Zeeman, you get a flowing current. Now you maybe have to start thinking about how the current is.
I equilibrate in the Zeeman. I use a spin density and then ask.
Yeah, so, okay. So you have to be careful because if you apply a magnetic field to the surface, you want to sort of apply an infinitesimal gradient to just generate a current. If you apply a larger...
Why infinitesimal? I mean,
because otherwise you actually change the character of the surface. You gap out the surface.
So a finite cube modulation, small cube. If you want to discuss transport diffusion, you have to have some window of cues to...
Yeah, okay, so let me put it this way. If you want to think physically, you want to think about thermal conductivity. Thermal conductivity...
I mean, I want to access spin directly. Oh, look, I mean, okay, Jorenstein measured spin diffusion constant in semiconductors by shining these sort of polarized lasers.
Right, right.
So, but essentially doing this experiment, you would set up a grating on the surface of potentials that would, basically draw the spin magnetization. And then with the same laser, you would basically do scattering against that gradient and see that scattering, that gradient decay with a diffusion constant and a spin orbit relaxation.
So I don't want to talk about spin when the spin orbits. So in the case of, say, class D3...
There's no spin orbit. Let's not talk
right.
about it.
I want to conserve quantity.
We actually measured, so basically if you look at the relaxation versus Q squared, it's a straight line. And if that straight line intercepts at zero, great, you have no spin orbit.
You're sort of getting ahead of ourselves because we don't actually have materials yet to do the experiments on. I think it would be worth trying if we can find materials that...
I'm just saying that this connection to Biedem and Franz is unnecessary given the recent advances in directly...
Potentially.
Okay.
Right, so you can formally write down this Kubo formula, but usually you have to stop here, right? Because these are random Green's functions, and so typically, say if you're on the metallic side, you average over disorder somehow, and this single Feynman diagram becomes an infinite series, and you have to organize it in a certain way. You can calculate it perturbatively, blah, blah, blah. But for this funny system, and so this is the one aspect that really is very special to these topological superconductors, there's a shortcut. And this is actually due to Andreas, although I'm going to give a more recent derivation due to Sacha Merlin. And so the key idea is to exploit this funny version of time reversal symmetry. And what that allows you to do is to rewrite this term, where I have an advanced Green's function, retarded Green's function, and make it look like this one. And I mean, I don't want to focus too much on details here, but what I'm really doing here, I'm calculating the conductivity, say, in some direction. So this is a current operator. It's just a Pauli matrix. But alpha here could be 1 or 2, x or y. And so when I do this replacement, I go from, say, 1, 1, 1, 1 to now 1, 1, and 2, 2. So I just get a sum over those two directions. Now, that by itself is actually not that special. So it turns out that time reversal can always be put in this form when you're talking about quasi-particles of a superconductor. But what is very special here is that what this matrix does, and this is a basis-independent statement, it just interchanges the direction of the current operators. That's special. And so now the second ingredient is I can come and use the U1 Ward identity, which is just a statement of current conservation, but expressed in terms of single particle Green's functions. And what it tells me is that if I have two Green's functions of the same type at the same energy, and I'm integrating over R, so this is like a convolution, if you wish, and in between is sitting the current operator, not anything else. It has to be the current operator. It can't be a current operator times, say, a matrix in Valley space or something like this. Then I can reduce this product to a single Green's function. And if you want, these are Schwinger terms in the Ward identity.
What's alpha?
So alpha is just a direction, a particular direction. So alpha can be 1 or 2. So I just mean take the x or y component of this vector.
Okay.
So we use time reversal to write it in terms of two retarded Green's functions. And then we use the Ward identity to reduce this to a single Green's function. And you can already sort of get a sense of how this is going to work. Now, if I use the Ward identity, these two positions are actually the same. So this is actually ill-defined, because I'm going to replace this with a Green's function that's like gr1 r1 times r1 minus r1. So I have to regularize that somehow. But I can point split it in some fashion. And basically, the physics is going to be that the conductivity, no matter what the disorder is doing, is given by the short distance behavior of this Green's function. But the return to Green's function just satisfies some simple differential equation. It has to give you a delta function at short distances. So imagine if I look at that Green's function on distances shorter than the mean free path, then I can just use the clean Green's function. And you can evaluate this many different ways. And what you get is just a universal number, 1 over 8 pi squared. And then there's a trace over valley space or color space. And so I get the modulus of the winding number here. So this is an old result. This is first in Andreas's paper, which is that you expect universal spin and also thermal conductivity for these surface states in the absence of interactions. So this is what was already known. So there are no weak localization corrections of any kind, but the system is also not ballistic, meaning there is a well-defined conductivity.
So in the clean limit, if I really don't take the clean limit, but I actually work at the clean limit, these are interband terms?
They are not interband terms.
They're
That's very important. So the AC the optical conductivity and the DC conductivity don't commute. You get different answers whether you take omega to zero first, say at finite t, versus taking t to zero first and then omega to zero.
Different numbers.
You get different numbers, yeah. And I'm not going to talk about optical conductivity at all because I don't know how to calculate it.
So how do you get a, if there's no disorder, how do I get a finite DC conductivity?
Yeah, well, so you have to ask, what does this number mean in the clean limit?
At the clean limit.
Right, and so what it is, it's the Landauer conductance of a Dirac system when you dope it exactly to the Dirac point, and you measure, say, a small sample at very low temperatures. This has actually been done in small samples of graphene by Eva Andres Grud. Yeah, Marcus.
But that conductance depends on the aspect ratio, no?
Yeah, so in that case, the at finite temperature depends on the aspect ratio. But there's a well-defined conductivity at zero temperature.
So the conductance of your sample would then be sigma times circumference divided by length, Ohm's formula. Is that the meaning of this conductivity?
Yeah, so the claim is that that would not be true here. So we're not doing a Landauer, we're not doing the proper Landauer calculation. We're just calculating the bulk Kubo conductivity. But the claim is that here, this is just an intrinsic conductivity. It happens to take the same value as what you would measure in this Landauer setup. So in the Landauer, there's a certain limit, I forget, it's like when you take the sample very wide and it's short, that you get E squared over H independent of W and L. There's a certain limit where you would get measured just E squared over pi H. And so what I'm saying is that in a very clean graphene sample, there's a way to actually get this number, but it's not generic, because if your sample's larger, there's disorder, and indeed, even if you were in this ballistic limit, if your sample's larger, it ends up depending on the aspect ratio. So, yes.
But just a little bit distant example. When you consider just ordinary two-particle system,
yes,
heavy and light electrons and holes, and then it's known that the real part of the conductivity is finite because of the motion, internal motion, but imaginary part of the conductivity has a pole which corresponds to, in the clean limit, which corresponds to the motion of the liquid as a whole. Mm-hmm. And then the question, if you have such a pole in your case, how, you see, this motion will shunt any possibility to measure the real part of the conductivity. How experimentally can you distinguish the finite conductivity at the background of ideal conductivity?
I think the only answer I have for that is that, so there has been some numerics done on systems like this, and I think when you just, I think this is just giving you an intrinsic conductivity. It's just an intrinsic conductivity that is basically set by an anomaly.
Yes, this is the real part, but if you calculate the imaginary part of this expression, of the Kubo expression, you get a pole.
I don't think there's a pole in the imaginary part.
In the clean limit, of course.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, right. So in the dirty limit, I actually don't know how to calculate that. But I don't think there's a problem. Anyway, this is Andreas's work, so I don't want to spend the entire talk defending it. But what I can say is that this result is obtained by multiple different authors and multiple different methods, and it's always the same result. It's basically an anomaly, right? So anomalies in quantum field, they're always confusing because you get some non-zero, non-infinite results, but you find the same way, the same result when you do the calculation different ways. So I think this really is a special property of these topological superconductor surface state. So what we wanted to do is see, is this really robust? So what if we consider interaction effects on top of this? So there's no weak focalization to any order, but typically if you have an interacting disordered system at low temperature, you also have so-called Altshuler-Ernoff corrections to transport coefficients. And physically, you could think of these as you have impurities, and the impurities create Friedel oscillations. They create inhomogeneity in the density of the local environment. And so now when you think about your electron propagating through this system, it's going to self-consistently scatter not just off of the impurities, but also off of the Friedel oscillations. So what we did was to just brute force, we actually did two things, but the first thing we did was to brute force write out the quantum corrections, say using the exact single particle Green's functions and a fixed realization disorder, just working order by order in the interactions. And I claim this is a reasonable thing to do because, you know, normally if you're trying to calculate, say, on conductivity due to interactions, you would need to work to all orders, but we already have an order one conductivity at zeroth order, so we just want to see other corrections to that. But I claim, and I don't have time to go through the proof, but we've checked this through two loops. And so I should really say this was Hong Yi's work, and I was very impressed that he was able to go to two loops. We find that all these corrections vanish. And we use only two ingredients. So when we look at each of these diagrams, we don't know much. All we know is basically this anomalous form of time reversal symmetry and the U1 word identity. But what we can show is that if you organize the perturbation theory in a certain way, the contributions to the DC zero temperature conductivity vanish. So you have to do things in a very specific limit. You have to take frequency to zero first, then take temperature to zero, then you take the diagram, subtract its imaginary part to get the real part of the conductivity, and use these two facts over and over again. And mathematically, how it basically works at higher orders is you can think of a single conductivity bubble as if I take out the current operators, that's like a free energy correction. And so then what you're doing is you're sort of inserting the current operators in every position. And if you sum over that using this chirality and using the fact that I can make all my advanced Green's functions retarded, they cancel.
Does it depend on the range of interactions, short range or long range?
Good, yes. So we only consider short range.
Short range.
Only short range, because we're thinking these are quasi-particles.
So interaction just was a constant amplitude, right?
Yes.
Independent of...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I'm confused.
Yes.
So the conclusion is that these potential corrections vanish at all orders?
So the
general argument that then you don't have to do the two loops. I'm a bit confused. Why do you...
Well, let me say exactly what we showed. What we showed is that they vanish through two loops. And actually, I think in the paper, we only considered corrections of... So it turns out in this particular class, there are two types of interactions. And I think we only considered the corrections that are sort of diagonal. But I went back and checked at least one class of cross terms, and they vanish as well. So Hong Yi has a sketch of how we think this works to all orders, involving this picture of inserting current operators at different positions and summing over them. But it's even given that picture, it's kind of a complicated calculation. You can look at the paper.
And these are general P theory argument based on some...
Well, so that's what's missing. So we would love an anomaly argument, but we don't have one. So, people have talked about transport using anomalies, but it's always when you break time reversal on the surface. So, but let me, we have a physical picture for why this is true, and we have a completely separate calculation that gives the same answer.
Did you account for disorder?
Yes.
Zara-Naroshny Alenier across diagrams. Did you account for that?
Which diagrams?
When the impurity line crosses the interaction line.
These are exact Green's functions in a fixed realization of disorder. So we know almost nothing about them. But we're just exploiting these two facts, and I claim we can show they vanish in a fixed realization of disorder. So there are no impurity lines. These are somehow the exact single particle.
But there's not enough.
So it is, the equation is in the interaction. So
in the interaction only.
First order and the second order.
First order and second order, yes. Yes,
yes, but you see, in the interacting system with impurities, it's not possible to express everything only in terms of Green's functions, because there are also vertex corrections. And
No. So those vertex corrections would only appear if I was averaging over disorder.
Yes.
I'm not averaging over disorder. I'm saying in a fixed realization of disorder.
Sorry.
This is normally this would not work. So something very special is happening here. So let me give a physical picture for what we think is going on. And this is a bit hand waving, but basically we think that there are no Oelschler-Aronoff corrections because the surface fluid has to remain completely uniform. In the sense that you could ask, well, in order to get Oelschler-Aronoff corrections, you have to have Friedel oscillations in something, in some density. But all of the notions of density that you would like to define, spin density, color density, even charge density, charge density is slightly separate. But for color and spin density, if those were to become non-zero, due to the quench disorder, you would actually be breaking time with the symmetry. So the picture is just that this you have this completely homogeneous fluid, so of course there are no Oelschler-Aronoff corrections. And
it seems like if I just introduce disorder in the local speed, I just locally modulate that. What if I just locally...
So we have not considered irrelevant terms. That would be very interesting, but we haven't done it.
I mean, ordinary, if you like, Feynman type theorem arguments would say that if I introduce some kind of modulation, I should be introduced into the Hamiltonian, I should be induced modulation in physical observation.
But look, what we're using is a very general statement. It's just the statement of time reversal symmetry and the Ward identity. So the only way it's going to be an issue is if you include enough irrelevant terms that you change the form of time reversal symmetry.
But if you have long-range interaction, does it spoil the picture?
This we're not sure. We didn't. So there definitely are diagrams.
No,
for example,
I think it is important that it is short-range for using these things.
Yeah. So I have nothing to say about long-range interactions. But
so
now,
you didn't use any explicit expression for Green's function at all.
Not at all.
Even Lebesgue representation, you didn't use.
Sorry,
even Lebesgue representation when you just. In terms of unknown,
we do use a layman type representation at some point, but again, in terms of wave functions that we don't know anything about,
sure.
Other than this chirality. So now let me give a completely different derivation using this will get us to some technology, even though the route is going to seem a bit different, that is more common in the interacting disordered metal insulator transition business. We get there via route using conformal field theory. So here's another way to attack this problem. So let me take the clean system, the clean Dirac fermion system, and write an imaginary state path integral. I always do that, so here it is, here's the action, and I have some Grossmann field, and the only thing that's important is that the Grossmann field carries a bunch of indices. Okay, so the Grossmann field has an index kappa, that's my color, runs from 1 to the modulus of the winding number. Then I'm also going to have to, I want to imagine averaging over disorder at the end of the day. So I need some way of doing that. This is an interacting system. I can't use supersymmetry. I'm just going to use replicas. So I have another index A, which runs from, say, 1 to the number of replicas. And finally, this is a very weird thing to do, but imagine I'm working at finite temperature. Let me think of this omega sub n as an index on my Dirac field. So I think of my Dirac field as a two-dimensional object with just a whole bunch of indices. So then you can go to chapter 15 of the Big Yellow Book or go back to Ed Witten's original paper on non-abelian bosonization. Non-abelian bosonization tells us that we can replace this trivial theory with some horrible looking matrix theory, which is a Wessamino-Novikov-Witten model. So it tells us that in particular, if I have a fermion bilinear like this with these indices, left indices and right indices, that I can think of that, I can connect that to some matrix Q, which is a unitary matrix that carries the same indices. And then the action is some gradient term. I can also bosonize the frequency term using this rule. And there's some term of topological origin, of Wessamino-Novikov.
Wait, just returning to the previous part. Interaction.
Yeah.
Was it just in... the charge sector, or it was also exchange?
Right, so I glossed over that. So we consider all generic short-inch interactions that are invariant under the Clover
all of them. All these
are triplet. So actually, charge falls out because these are quasi-particles, but there's a triplet interaction and there's a Cooper interaction.
And the triplet interaction also does not...
Yeah, we do it for both, exactly. And I'll come to that in a little bit. But okay, so you can always formally make this replacement. Normally, this would be a completely ridiculous thing to do, to take a 2 plus 1D free Dirac 3 that I know everything about and write it in terms of this crazy matrix field theory, because this thing is strongly coupled. This is an order one number. You can't do anything with this theory normally. But here, we're saved. And we're saved by the very special way the disorder couples to the theory. The disorder couples only to the currents. Only to the color currents. Technically, colors, it couples only to the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic color currents. And so you can do two things. One is that you could take that Dirac theory, average over disorder, and ask, is the disorder relevant or not? You'll find it's always relevant when it's not abelian. So you're flowing off to somewhere else. The clean description is unstable. But because it only couples to the currents, these topological superconductors are in one-to-one correspondence with certain rules in conformal field theory called conformal embeddings. And actually, each class corresponds to a particular embedding. And roughly what it means is that if I want to incorporate the effects of disorder, I could add a disorder term to this clean description. What it's going to do is basically localize the color degree of freedom on Q. So that's my claim. And so if I want the effective description of the disordered system, basically the idea is that the color sector becomes inert, becomes massive in the parlance of high energy physics. And so I can just trace over it. So I get a factor k here, a factor k here. K is the winding number or half the winding number of one of the classes. And so now this is the model that I need to work with. But this model becomes tractable when the winding number becomes large. I can just do perturbation theory. So this is enabled by this conformal embedding story. So now, if you look at this theory and you ignore this term, I have these matrices that have frequency and replica indices. I have a parameter here, which is equal to 1 over k, but it looks like a diffusion constant in a nonlinear sigma model. And I have a parameter here, which is coupling to frequency. This looks like the dynamical version of the nonlinear sigma model that people have been writing down since the 90s to study disordered interacting electronic systems, even though we've obtained it via a completely different route, via conformal field theory. And also, we can use the map that we know connecting the Q matrix to fermion bilinears to actually write down generic short-range interactions. These are anything that are local in time and local in replicas. So this is in some particular class, I think class C1, and so we just write down all the generic interactions.
I just have a question. The winding number is, just to go back, and we've translated a lot of things, but the winding number counts the number of gapless, the number of Dirac fermions.
The number of colors, yeah, exactly.
So I'm a little worried that if you're talking about an interacting system now,
yes,
and you know, with then H should be somehow special, right? But you're taking a large limit.
So there's weak interactions.
Yeah, weak interactions. Completely ignoring
it. So I'm thinking about, say, perturbing the Dirac 3 with a little bit of disorder and a little bit of interactions. And in that case, the disorder is in the driver's seat because the disorder is a logarithm, is a marginal perturbation taking you into strong coupling. The interactions are actually initially decaying very fast.
Yeah.
And what we're going to do is we're going to go and sit at the conformal field theory that describes the delocalized system and ask, what do interactions do there?
Okay, so but a little worry question is that the topological protection, though you might worry, is not present for like if k was a multiple of 8, right? Even with interactions, you're not gapping.
I don't know how to show that, but we'll show that actually the topological protection is actually not always present anyway.
Okay.
Even for,
okay.
Yeah, so Andreas.
So technically Q is a very big matrix
because
it incorporates the infinite Matsubara matrix.
Exactly.
So should we think of truncating it or how
do you think? Yeah, we can think of truncating it in the sense that if you want to ask what is this algebra, then I should put capital N here, which is like the number of modulus Matsubara frequencies.
Can you not go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
Or did I miss something?
Okay, so the point is that, you know, up to now this was standard conformal field theory, but it was useless. But the disorder that's very special in this case gives us a theory that is tractable, but that also looks a lot like the normal so-called Finkelstein interacting sigma models that people used back in the 90s and the 80s to study interacting electronic systems. The crucial difference, of course, is this Wessonino term. Lysimino Novikov Witten term. Our referees insisted that we include Novikov. Rightly so. Okay, so I'm not going to show you how we do the calculations, but this is a standard in weakly interacting field theory. You can do an expansion. This is basically like a large N expansion, where N is the number of colors. And you can calculate the one loop corrections for this parameter that we want to interpret as the resistance of the system. And so actually, in each of the three classes, we've done this. This was, again, work done by Hong Yi and by my graduate student, Yang Zi. And for example, if we take this class C1, you get two types of corrections. You get a weak localization correction. You get an Altshuler-Aronoff correction. And these corrections are actually now to all orders in the interactions, because this is a large N expansion. Similarly, class A3, here's an Altshuler-Aronoff correction. Class D3, there's weak anti-localization and an Altshuler-Aronoff correction. But the key point is that because of the Lysimino term, each one comes with a prefactor. And if I set this parameter lambda equal to the value that CFT tells me I should set it to, they all vanish. So this is just a one-loop calculation, but it gives the same results as the brute force perturbation theory calculation we did in a completely different language.
What is lambda?
Lambda I want to interpret as the resistance, say the spin or thermal resistance of the system. We haven't done a careful calculation of correlation functions.
Okay, but this initial condition, lambda is 1 over k, it is derived initially, and then you show that it doesn't change.
Right, yeah. So there's a technical issue here. So I can, this coefficient should be k over 8 pi, but I've just tuned it to something else just to do the calculation for the sake of argument, because I want to see if there should be corrections if this is not tuned to this special value. I cannot tune the coefficient of this guy because that would make the model ill-defined. So, long story short, there seem to be no Altshuler-Aronoff corrections, and what is really missing here is some deep topological, you know, anomaly argument or something like this. What it seems to suggest is that these surface Majorana fluids of topological superconductors are a lot like the Inger quantum Hall effect. I mean, surface transport coefficients are really quantized, and you would have to believe that there's some deep reason for this, but I don't know enough Chern-Simons theory or whatever, you know, 3D to call it BF theory or whatever you need to connect this. I'm not sure I don't know if it's just a fluke or there's some deep meaning for it.
But the physical picture of the transport is pretty different because
yes,
you don't have edge characters.
It's a two-dimensional system. Exactly. There is, in some sense, there's still a notion of chirality. That's why that's why you can use conformal field theory, but it's a different notion of chirality. But okay, so let me get to the second part of the talk. So the second part of the talk is, this is all assuming these surface states are stable. But we haven't checked that yet. Yeah, Marcus.
Would there be other effects or measurements that would tell you that there are no Friedel oscillations?
You have to ask what you're measuring in tunneling. So if you're measuring the charge density profile, that actually corresponds to the current, to a component of the non-abelian current. So you would have to ask, okay, can you somehow measure the color density or the mass density? Mass density, any of these things would break time reversal. So if you have a squid or something, you look for a magnetization or something. Also, you should see the gap. I mean, as long as the thing is gapless in ORPES, if you have the energy resolution, then you know these things are somehow not there.
Usually, Friedel oscillation is something with a finite k of.
Right.
If there were Friedel oscillations, there would be at the k separating the.
That's true. So that's a special property of these quasi-particle systems, is that you're always sitting right at the Dirac point. But the fact that these corrections vanish is due to the Lysimino term. So, for example, you can have similar types of sigma models that describe non-topological quasi-particle systems. So one that was worked on by Andreas's previous student is, imagine you take a type 2 superconductor and you have a bunch of vortices in it, right? And you have quasi-particles hopping from vortex to vortex. So that is also described by some sigma model, and there's no notion of KF, but there are Altshuler-Aronoff corrections. So there's a crucial difference there. And it's because time reversal works in a different way. Well, that's actually a time reversal broken system.
All right. So I just wanted to to know your opinion. So you, in any case, you always treated it perturbatively in the interaction, right? Mm-hmm. So as we are on diagrammatics or one loop, it is all up to the lambda squared, so to say, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's we go to second order in the interactions,
yeah, right.
Or
so
first
do
order
you believe in that that it is unlikely that if you go further on in higher orders that something happens? Or
I think so. I think it's unlikely, and I think actually if we worked hard enough on the Ulcheller-Aronoff side, we may be able to show it, or we could at least probably show three loops. With the sigma model, the calculations become very complicated.
Okay, so what we have to see is that we know that up to second order.
Yes. Yes.
What happens then? We
Yeah. But also, you know, second order in the interactions or lowest order in the winding number all orders in the interactions. But I mean, in the RPA sense.
I find these statements about hyper-uniformity, if you like, of your system, despite the solar, a bit troubling. Because, yeah, I mean, I don't have to introduce impurities. I can just terminate the system.
Yeah, but so if you ask how does the fluid go over an edge,
right.
That's a very strong perturbation. And I'm not necessarily claiming that this is captured by this low energy theory. That's an interesting question.
Strong disorder.
That's, I mean, right. Right. Well, but if the disorder is strong enough, then your low energy effective field theory isn't good anyway.
Right. Too many questions. I know the following, that if you take a usual case, not topological, and
right.
You consider Finkelstein
yes.
theory,
yes.
Then actually it is very difficult to go to higher orders
yes.
in the disorder. But
yes.
It is relatively easy to write something nonlinear in the interaction. So for instance,
I'm claiming that I'm already doing that. So these are to all. I haven't written these out explicitly. These are
okay,
to all
so
orders.
So this function alone.
These are nonlinear. Yeah, these are to all orders. I didn't write them. Sorry. But sorry. So let me try to skip ahead and in the last 15 minutes talk about the other part. So the other part of this is that it seems like disorder does nothing. Right? It doesn't seem to affect transport coefficients at all. So you might think that, okay, the system is going to actually be completely uniform. The wave functions are not going to have any interesting structure, and this has no relation to normal localization physics. But actually, that's not true.
But when we are talking about the first loop order
yes.
of this equation,
yes,
so
yes, yes.
it is first loop order in the disorder or?
In the disorder.
In the disorder.
In the disorder.
So that's why you have two complementary considerations.
Exactly.
One of them was exact in the disorder, but second order in interaction. And the other one, was sort of exact in the Finkelstein sense in the interaction, but was second order in disorder. So
exactly.
These are two. It is not the same.
No, they're they overlap, but they also have separate.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is.
Okay. So it seems like disorder does nothing. Now we know that normally, if you're in two dimensions, so this is just a nice plot that my graduate student, that Yang Zi, put together. These are some highly localized states, you know, near a band edge in a localized system in two dimensions, periodic boundary conditions. So this guy is the same as this guy, but there are four of them. Why am I showing you four of them? I want to show you four states that are very nearby in energy. And so we all know that in an Anderson insulator, states that are nearby in energy are very well separated in space, right? So what do the wave functions look like for these topological superconductor surfaces? Are they just trivial plane waves that fill the volume? The answer is not at all. They are strongly multifractal. Their statistics have been known for a long time. You can calculate them exactly using conformal field theory. And so here I've again plotted the probability densities associated with four different wave functions that are nearby in energy. But for the purpose right now, you can just look at one of them. So say look at the green one. So I think I'm gonna try to go fast through this. So this type of wave function profile, where the wave function is sort of zero everywhere and just has these rare peaks, this is something that's well known when you sit at an Anderson metal insulator transition. It's been most extensively studied at the plateau transition in the integer quantum Hall effect. So this is a plot I stole from Evers of such an extended wave function sitting right at the transition. This is just a single wave function. And one way to encode the statistics of such a rare state is using something called the singularity spectrum. It's a multifractal spectrum, f of alpha. And so I can't get into details, but the idea is the following. The idea is that you take the sample and you break it up into level sets, and over a given level set where mod psi squared is proportional to L to the minus alpha, the measure of the sample is L to the F of alpha. So F of alpha is the dimension of the level set. And so now you can say numerically come and calculate this thing, plot F of alpha as a function of alpha, and that will somehow encode the statistics of a typical wave function. And so here's some very old data on the integer quantum Hall effect. And the most remarkable aspect of this business in single particle localization is that these statistics are actually universal. So to me is still sort of mind-blowing, because you would think that things depend on the details of the disorder, but no, the wave function fluctuations themselves are actually completely universal, at least as long as you don't look at super high moments, maybe something happens. And so here's a plot of this F of alpha versus alpha for a real space Hamiltonian, electrons moving in a magnetic field and a random potential. Here's a tight bonding model. The best calculations are done with, I think, network models. And the point is that you get the same curve in different disorder realizations, different models. And also for a plane wave, the result would just be a single spike here of width 0 and height 2, because we're in two dimensions.
What's Q?
Q refers to if we're taking moments of the wave function, and then you take a Legendre transformation to get the F of alpha curve. So for these topological superconductor surfaces, remember I told you that at the level of a single particle problem, they're in one-to-one correspondence with the certain conformal embedding rules. So you can actually use the effective low-energy field theory, which is some Katz-Moody algebra. So technically the way it works is that you have a description of the clean system, but then the disorder couples only to the currents, only to the color currents. And so it turns out that with these embedding rules, you can write the clean system as, in some sense, a product or a sum, depending on how you look at it, of the replica theory, the replica current theory, and the color theory. The color theory goes away, and I'm left with some replica theory that I can just do calculations in with conformal field theory. And so the exact results are known for all three classes. This first calculations were done way back in the 90s by these gentlemen. And it turns out this F of alpha is purely parabolic. And the only thing that it depends on is the single parameter, which I call theta. Theta depends on the winding number. And it's just given by some expression. So the first calculation was done for class A3. We just generalized this to class C1 and class D3. And then we wanted to check this. So Yang Zi, in a paper with me, did some momentum space exact diagonalization calculations. And we checked both the multifractal spectrum, F of alpha, versus the analytical prediction, and also the density of states versus the analytical prediction. And in particular, this is in class A3, where there's this additional tunable disorder parameter, an aficionado. And it seems to work. I'm not claiming our numerics are state of the art, but it seems to work. Okay, so why am I telling you about this? So the final question we want to ask is, are these surface states stable? And I claim that to answer that question, it's actually very similar to any other problem of an interacting disordered metal insider transition. And it's the interplay of multifractality and local interactions that plays the key. So this is this plot I showed you before. And now if you notice, if you look at these different wave functions, you see something very strange, which is that although a given wave function looks very random, it's a bunch of rare peaks, different wave functions tend to have their peaks sitting in the same position. They tend to nest like Russian dolls. This is one version of Chandra scaling. And that can be encoded in the following sense. So if I take a given single particle probability, and I multiply it by the probability of a wave function at some energy that's epsilon higher, and I integrate this over the volume, and technically I have to take the L goes to infinity limit to get the scaling limit I want, the argument is that this goes as the energy splitting to some power divided by 1 over L squared, and the power depends on the second multifractal exponent and also the dynamic particle exponent. But I think the most important idea is that, this is really why scaling theory works, because you have these highly rarefied wave functions. So in order for there to be a well-defined notion of a mobility edge and to be able to scale away from it, it has to be, the only way that can work is that the peaks of the different wave functions have to sit right on top of each other. Because otherwise, if you had peaks that were not sitting right on top of each other, you would have basically zero overlap. And it wouldn't make sense to talk about scaling in energy. Now, in something like MBL, maybe something like this breaks down. I don't know. Now, for my purposes, the most important notion is that this can enhance matrix elements. So,
wait a minute, just a quick question. Yeah. So, that's for critical wave functions.
Yes.
For ergodic wave functions, there is some remnant of local love repulsion that fixes the value of mu, or no?
So for ergodic wave functions, effectively there's a correlation length. Shorter than that correlation length, you have multifractal scaling. Larger than that, in a session, in essence, you're just sewing together regions. Validio would be the person.
Actually, so you're saying that this would even hold if, because R and R for the different ones, you're always inside the critical sort of.
So if you look on, if you're scaling wave functions and you're looking at the correlations between just ergodic wave functions, what ends up happening is that this tau of 2 goes to 2. It goes to the number of spatial dimensions.
Right.
So your scaling would just be trivial in that case. It just goes to a constant. But so the key idea is that this multifractality can enhance matrix elements because of this nesting of single particle interactions, in particular short-range interactions, which is what we're interested in here. And this has been used to discuss the superconducting insulator transition in these works. And we're going to use the same idea here. So, okay, I'm getting really low on time, but this is again, so what we're going to do is we're going to add generic short-range interactions, and we're going to ask whether they destabilize the non-interacting conformal field theory, basically. We can do the calculation two different ways. One, by scaling, where we're just taking data from the CFT, and so we can write down exact scaling relations that are good only to lowest order in the interaction strength, but that work for any winding number. Or we can take the large winding number limit and use the Finkelstein model, and then we can get nonlinear corrections in the interactions. But that's only good to lowest order in 1 over k. So I think I should probably skip the details, but basically you can write the tree-level equation for a generic short-range interaction, the tree-level renormalization group equation for a generic short-range interaction like this. It's some dimension times u plus nonlinear terms. And the two dimensions that are coming in here are actually the dimension associated with the local density of states and a dimension associated with the matrix element. And it turns out that the dimension associated with the matrix element is always greater than or equal to the dimension delta 2, which is what governs the second multifractal exponent. So what I'm saying is that the largest enhancement you can get is if the matrix elements of the interaction are governed by the same second multifractal exponent. But whether that happens or not depends on details. It depends on the particular interaction in a particular model. But we know how to do that in the CFT by just looking at different short-range, different local operators and mapping them to certain interactions. And the other way we can do the calculation is by just going back to the Finkelstein model and doing RG. So maybe I'll just go through one particular example. So the first class we actually considered in this paper with Emil is class C1. So this is a class that actually has full spin SU2 symmetry. And so we write down a bunch of generic short-range interactions. So because spin is conserved, so generally in a disordered interacting diffusive or critical system, the interactions that are important are the interactions that correspond to a conservation law. So spin-spin interactions are going to be important here. But in addition, because these systems are always time reversal invariant, there's always a Cooper interaction, which I can think of as the square of the mass operator. So the mass operator is just psi dagger or sigma 3 psi. But so what that would correspond to is, if you made it very strong, it would be a Cooper instability of the surface, which in the absence of disorder is very artificial. But in principle, it could happen. And it also turns out that at the surface of a topological superconductor, so if you induce a pairing instability and you gap it out, you have to simultaneously break time reversal. So one way of saying is that if you try to pair these quasiparticles at the surface of a topological superconductor, if you try to do it in a time reversal invariant way, that's equivalent to some vector potential that you can just gauge away. So the only way to actually gap out the surface is to sort of P plus IP pair, but you're pairing the surface relative to the bulk with a non-trivial phase. And so what we can do, and these appear in certain funny combinations, the funny combinations are just because these are eigenoperators in the conformal field theory, so we can go and we can calculate these lowest order dimensions. And to our surprise, what we found is that there's one particular interaction that for any winding number is actually always relevant. Always relevant. And you should compare this to the clean case. In the clean case, any short-range interaction is strongly irrelevant. So our conclusion for this particular class was that actually there is no topological protection. So we draw this phase diagram. So on this axis, this is the, you know, some generic short-range interaction, but in particular, this interaction that causes our instability, and this is disorder. So if I don't have any disorder, I'm clean, and as long as my interactions aren't too strong, I always pull back. On the other hand, if I turn on a little bit of disorder, the disorder is a much more relevant perturbation. It's marginal rather than being irrelevant, and so I start to flow this way. And if I had no interactions, I would terminate at this nice conformal field theory. But what we've shown is that this guy is actually unstable. So if you actually are starting out here with weak interactions, weak disorder, you're going to flow. Maybe you'll come very close to this, but then you go off somewhere else. And so at the level of conformal field theory, all we can do is say this is unstable. We can't say where we're going. You can go a little bit further and look at the flow in the coupling space in the Finkelstein model, which incorporates nonlinear terms and the beta functions for the interactions. And what we find is that there's no non-trivial critical fixed point in this class. So it seems like the system either wants to flow to strong triplet coupling, in which case maybe we get some kind of surface magnetic order, or it wants to flow actually, the dominant instability is actually towards gapping out the surface with a mass, so some kind of surface superconductivity. So I think in the interest of time, I'll basically stop there. I'll say, let me say that for these other two classes, this doesn't happen. So the other two classes, you could have stable surface states in the presence of both disorder and interactions. It's a slightly complicated story. In one particular case, in class D3, it turns out that the interaction matrix elements never get enhanced by multifractality. It's just a different operator. So in that case, even though D3 you would naively actually expect to have the strongest effect, because it turns out that the density of states is actually, the global density of states is actually strongly enhanced. But because the matrix elements are not.
But does it mean that Chomsky scaling is violated in this?
No, Chomsky scaling is never violated anywhere here. It just means that you have to look at, you have to be calculating the right local operator. And so the interaction operator in that case has a different dimension for any winding number than the local operator that includes the second multifractal element.
So the statement is, in this other case, is that the fixed points that correspond to class C1 here are perturbatively stable. That's what the statement is.
Yes, so exactly. So the statement is that, in particular in class A3, we find something very funny. So as you tune this additional U1 disorder parameter, there's a window where this thing is just stable. Then actually, as you tune outside of it, we seem to find a new critical fixed point that is actually perturbatively accessible as long as you don't tune the disorder too far.
Do I understand correctly that you can compute this multifractal mu exponent both at the original fixed point and the interaction control for the Wilson-Fisher analog?
So you mean here?
Yeah.
So this is the non-interacting guy. And
so at the non-interacting one, you can get the mu.
You can get everything.
But at the interaction perturbed mu fixed point, can you?
So the interaction perturbed one, so these are gap phases.
These are gap.
But in class A3, where there's a perturbatively accessible fixed point, you could, and I think you would have to do it in the Finkelstein model, but yes, in principle. It's probably a two-loop calculation. So Igor Burmistrov is the only person I think who has been brave enough to do this, but in a standard class, but it can be done in principle.
So can I say if the surface, if that's relevant, then the bulk is destroyed. There's no topological superconductor anymore.
No, that's actually not true, because it's nothing tells you
each correspondence.
The surface can break time reversal spontaneously. There's no problem with that, and it just means that now you can sort of loosely, you can unwind your winding number either by having a gapless thing at the surface or by just changing the symmetry as you go from the.
You mean the bulk will not change?
Yeah, the bulk will not change.
You can have these extraordinary transitions, the surface-only transitions. And
it's a surface-only transition.
Yeah, surface-only.
Right. So okay.
What happened to this bulk age correspondence? If the age changes, the bulk.
No, it's still true because the boundary always has to be unusual in some sense. That's always going to be preserved no matter what happens to the boundary. Technically, it can express some kind of anomaly that has to be there. And it's always there in all these phases that Matt is discussing.
Right.
So the box stay there. It's always.
So, okay, so that's it. And the only thing, I mean, obviously, you know, if we're really talking physics, what you really want are materials. But there's another interesting theoretical possibility, which I don't have much to say, but because if we have these cases where the surface is stable, the transport coefficients are precisely quantized, smells a lot like the integer quantum Hall effect. So there's been a lot of people working on strongly interacting symmetry-protected topological phases where you get something like a gapped Laughlin state at the surface of your topological superconductor insulator. This suggests that maybe something else exotic could happen. Imagine we had a 3D system with bulk topological order. Maybe you could get a system with a gapless surface that has fractional transport coefficients. I mean, I'm totally BSing here, but if this is the integer case, is there a fractional case? I have no idea.
So, if there are any burning questions?
Well, sorry, this is probably stupid, but I'm a bit confused about how line 2 and line 3 of your summary fit together. So in the first part of the talk, you showed that you have these universal transport coefficients,
right,
which are not affected by disorder or interactions.
Right.
But then in the final part, you showed that you can have some instabilities.
Right. So the usual instability you would have due to interactions would be like an Altshuler-Aronov effect. It would cause you to localize more. What I'm saying is that if you think about it in terms of the couplings of the theory, it's not an instability in the conductance directly. The conductance never shows any corrections, but your interaction blows up. And once you're in, so it's the beta function for the interaction blows up. And when the beta function for the interaction blows up, then sort of all hell breaks loose. So you should think of it as like, or at least the way I think about it is something like more like a Mach transition. So you're not seeing it in the conductance. There are no corrections to the conductance, but your interaction is getting bigger and bigger and bigger as you're going to longer and longer length scales or lower and lower temperatures. And eventually that interaction physics takes over and just pushes you into a different phase.
What is that? If you end up gapping the system out,
yeah.
It seems to me that, on some level these are coupled flow equations for the interaction and the conductance. At some point, the blow up of the interaction should just completely.
Right. I mean, the conductance will go to zero, or the conductivity will go to zero. Right. But that's not seen at the level of the perturbative beta functions.
What about the magnetic impurities, this anisotropy, which doesn't conserve, which breaks the spin conservation?
Yeah, so do you mean magnetic impurities in the sense of the Finkelstein transition or in the sense of just changing the symmetry?
Just the impurities. Then what is the difference?
So, I mean, it would change the symmetry class of the surface. There are some cases where at least if I ignore interactions and I freeze the impurities, you can still have any localized surface states. If you start thinking about the problem of like Kondo interactions between the impurities mediated by the surface states, that's an interesting problem, but I don't think anything is going to go.
All right, so in the interest of maintaining energy, let's take a 10-minute coffee bathroom break and then come back, having done some jumping jacks, we have to stop at the second. Yeah.